Purpose of these episodes not at all for advice or medical suggestions. These are aimed to provide support to peer pharmacists in training in educational and intellectually stimulating ways. Again, these are not at all for medical advice or medical suggestions. Please see your local board and state certified health professional. The views of this podcast represent those of my guests and I.
Welcome to the podcast series The New Student Pharmacist, where we discuss chemistry and pharmacy, as well as leaders in pharmacy careers, community, and chemistry and pharmacy research. We encourage you to support the work we are doing and follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts by subscribing for free. Note, the views on the podcast represent those of my guest and I.
Okay, welcome to the New Student Pharmacist Podcast Experience. It's so good to have you listening in today. My guest today is Mr. Paul Neal, owner of Vantage Point Commercial Capital. He's also the host of the Brick and Mortar Show, Brick and Mortar Money Show podcast. He's definitely accomplished in this field. Paul Neal is the owner of Vantage Point Commercial Capital and a trailblazer in empowering business owners to create wealth, autonomy, and control by owning their own commercial space. Not just an expert in commercial real estate, Paul is a master at making complex topics accessible and engaging. That's very powerful. His new book, Unleash Your Business, Unlock Wealth, Autonomy, and Control by Buying Your Building and Firing Your Landlord, delves into this transformative approach to commercial property ownership. Wow. The podcast guest, he brings a lot to the table. So welcome to, I'm happy to have him. Welcome, Mr. Paul Neal.
Yeah. Hey, David, I'm excited to be here today. Excited to talk to young budding professionals and entrepreneurs.
Yeah. So my question to you is, can you give us a quick snapshot of your career trajectory and your life story? What can you give us before we delve deep into like the transitions and the steps you took? What story could you share with us about your career that has really influenced and impacted you to the point where you have made these strides?
Yeah, sure. So I think it all began even sort of pre-career when I was young. I, for whatever reason, always had this desire to want to be free and do a lot of things and not be limited by what other people said I could do or have or whatnot. And so that was always kind of my underlying motivation, still is today. And so I thought my career path was to study engineering and work in the field of engineering. That's what I studied in college. My father was an engineer. Honestly, I didn't know a lot about it and what they did. I just was pretty good at math and science. And I thought, well, maybe I can use this to, you know, invent something or whatnot and, you know, and pursue my dreams and visions. And so, went down that road and, started working out in the field, and you want a story. So sort of a pivotal moment for me was as a newly sort of minted. In fact, actually, this was before I even finished school. I was in the co-op program, and one of the companies that I worked for, sort of like our co-op program is like an internship. And so, but you would work a quarter, and then we were on the quarter system back then. So you'd work a quarter, and then you're in school for two quarters, and then you're back at the company. So I was sitting in a conference room that had about eight people in it. And, we were in there, and we were designing, these network test boxes. And, this is sort of when, at the beginning of the internet, when it started to become a big thing. And these are custom designed for large companies. So each box was like $80,000, and you would make some different changes and whatnot on it. Well, the thing was, David, we sat around the room, and I was mostly sort of a bystander because I was, again, co-oping. They argued for 2 to 3 hours. It seemed like an eternity about the color of the little yellow or the little rubber booties that went on this $80,000 box. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. I was like, is this going to be what I'm going to do, you know, as an engineer? And so it really kind of made a deep impression on me at that point that I needed to do something on my own and go out into business. And actually was the catalyst for me to do that and start looking at, you know, how can I go into business for myself and own my own future. And that was kind of the one catalytic story.
Wow, that's good. That's good. I can relate in some ways. I started off doing engineering for the first 2.5 years of my career, and then I transitioned off to biochemistry, and it's been an interesting journey, a good and ever since. Now I'm in pharmacy school. So, yeah, that's a very interesting point that you made. So, as an entrepreneur yourself, how do you manage or how do you approach risk management when it comes to investing in commercial properties or investing in general? What's your framework? So obviously you've made some strategies, you've had some success, you've had a great degree of success. So how do you manage risks, even when it comes to like taking on new opportunities, on new investment opportunities, on new business opportunities, on new clients? How are you like framing risk in your approach?
Yeah. So I always sort of try to begin with the end in mind and say, okay, what is the outcome? What is the best possible outcome that can come from this scenario?
Okay.
And then on one side, and then what's the worst possible outcome, you know, that can happen? And you know, what's sort of the likely outcome? And I try to sort of run these scenarios, particularly like in finance, we can look a lot at numbers, and numbers will tell the story a lot. And all investments are really, you know, they should be numbers driven, right? They shouldn't really be emotionally driven. Emotions will lie to you, right? And they do frequently. And unfortunately, too many of us listen to our emotions. In fact, I think it was Warren Buffett that said, and he may not have been the original mentor of this, but he said, be greedy when others are fearful and fearful when others are greedy when it comes to investments. And so, you know, when everybody's on the bandwagon, that's the time to get off the bandwagon. And when nobody's on the bandwagon, that's the time to be looking to get in, right? So it's counterintuitive to what we feel, and which is hard because you're like, man, this just feels like the wrong thing to do. So then you have to then default to, okay, you know, again, the logic, the numbers, you know, what are we investing in? You know, we focus mostly in real estate, and real estate is, there's an art to it, but there's a whole lot of science to it. You know, like a lot of people will invest in real estate based on speculation, right? Like I'm going to buy this property and I think it's in a good area, and I'm sure in 5 years it's going to be worth a lot more money. Well, that's a very sort of warm and fuzzy feel good way to approach it. And it may work and it may not work. It's a little like going to Las Vegas, right? I mean, you don't know. I mean, I could put my money on red 23 and, you know, black 15 and hope the little ball lands there, right? Because I got a feeling. But more importantly, it's to understand what drives that investment, what drives the real estate. So, you know, what if I'm buying a building or buying an investment property, for instance, you know, as a lot of young, I have a lot of young entrepreneurs and young professionals that once they start their careers are making some money and they want to start investing, and a lot of them want to start in real estate. And so a lot of them will start with a single family investment and whatnot. And my recommendation and what I help them do is to understand, let's look at the cash flow of this property. Let's look, you're going to invest a certain amount of money as a down payment. Mm-hmm. And that money could be invested somewhere else, right? You have all these options on where you could put your down payment money. And so there's an opportunity cost when you invest it in one thing and not the other. But then let's look at what are the rents you're going to bring in? How are the rents going to increase? And you can make some educated guesses on that based upon the market. And there are some things you can do to improve a property to also increase the rents. You know, we can figure out very simply, you know, what's the debt service going to be on that? What is the mortgage payment? We know what the taxes and the insurance are going to be. And so we can then run some models and say, okay, well, if rents go up by X percent, then here's going to be your return. If they go up by, you know, less than that, here's your return. If the property never appreciates a dollar, here's your return. But oh, what if it does appreciate 3% a year or whatever? What's the return there? So then, and then you compare that to the other options that are out there. So it's a matter of really understanding, you know, where you're putting your money is probably, and how that works and what are the possible outcomes. And then you're not eliminating risk, but at least you're mitigating risk. You're understanding, you know, intelligently going in. And even so, you don't always win, you know, but you win many more times than you lose when you go into it with that kind of an attitude.
That perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause again, emotion, and I'm an emotional guy too. And I've made my share of mistakes, and that's, you know, it's always hard though to go left when everyone's going right, and, you know, vice versa, but that's where the money's made, you know, and most wealth is made in down economies, not surging economies. Cause there's things are on sale. You have opportunities to buy things. And, so many people that I know went in 2008 when real estate crashed, and they were buying properties literally for pennies on the dollar. And now those properties are worth a ton of money. And they did really, really well. But that's because they bought them when nobody wanted to buy them, you know, when the market had fallen out. So,
yeah. So I sound like I need to have you as a recurring guest, hopefully, on this podcast to talk more about money management and financial skills. This is good. This is good. So you talk about a range of possible outcomes. So, like, and you use models, you said, to outline what are the possible outcomes. I was listening. You know, I always admire financial people who are really knowledgeable in financial affairs or financial matters. I occasionally listen to Jamie Dimon, mm-hmm. and he talks about how when he's writing his yearly report, the yearly letter to his stakeholders or shareholders, he looks at a range of possible outcomes because, you know, in essence, you can't really predict the future, but you can look at a range of possible outcomes and make educated decisions based on that. That's very good. And you also bring up a second point, which you can mitigate risk. You can't really eliminate it, but you can mitigate it. So how often do you stress test these situations? Like, think about, like, if everything was to go wrong, what would be the end result? Do you stress test these financial models, or do you just look at, like, if this goes wrong or this goes wrong? Occasional.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so, you know, most entrepreneurs are, you know, very, they walk around with rose-colored glasses, right? And I tend to do that too. So, and that can be your friend. It motivates you to do things, but also can be your biggest enemy, right? Instead of, like, focusing on sort of worst-case scenarios, what we try to do is build margin into the numbers. So, for instance, like, you know, I've talked to my daughter about this all the time. It's like, well, if we only need to drive across town, it's 10 minutes to get there for an appointment, but we're only allotting 10 minutes, then inevitably something's going to come up and we're going to be late. Something's going to happen, right? You've got to have some margin in case the unexpected happens, because it always does. Things never go as well as you expect. They never are as easy as you expect. And I laugh a lot at like the, you see the, on HGTV, you know, the flipping home shows. And I think every show on that channel is now flip show in a different city and a different personality or whatever. But they make it look so easy. And at the end of the day, I always laugh because when I talk to people that are really doing it, you know, there's a lot of surprises along the way that you don't really know about, right? So that you open up this wall and turns out you've got an infestation of termites or whatever, you got to rewire the house or whatever. So margin's important. And the way we sort of mitigate it is you don't throw everything you got into a deal. You have to have some reserves on the sideline. So like financially, you want to have some liquidity. I call it dry powder. You want to have some cash on hand. As reserves, just in case things don't go well, you can generally weather your storm and get out of whatever situation you're in and be okay. When we do financial calculations, like on buying a commercial property, we look at what's called debt service coverage, and there's a margin in there. So basically, generally, the industry wants to see a 25% greater revenue, net revenue, than your debt service. So there's this 25% would be your profit margin, but it's also a safety margin, right? Mm-hmm. So in the event that something goes south, there's still some, there's some extra reserves to fall back on, and that's built in up front. And so that's going to limit, like you see right now, a lot of banks are cutting back on the amount of money or the percentage of money that they're going to loan on a particular piece of property, which means the borrowers are having to come to the table with more down payment money, more liquidity into the deal, because the banks are like, we want a little more margin in case the, you know, the property market doesn't go the way everyone wants it or hopes it to go. We're protected. And so as an investor, you have to kind of think the same way. You're like, okay, I know, ideally what I want, but worst case scenario, this could happen. Most likely neither are going to work. It's going to be somewhere in the middle. And so let me just kind of plan on that and emotionally plan on that, that if I expect this one deal is going to be my ticket to ride, right? Mm-hmm. It probably won't be, but if you do enough of those deals, eventually, you know, it works out generally in your favor.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, given that, so that's good. That's good. So given that you have experience and you've made some strides in the wealth management and wealth building space, what issues or problem or pain point areas can you identify within like the trajectory of like students, grad students, like budding professionals that you think your expertise really can contribute? Let me phrase it differently. So what advice do you have for people who are in that phase when it comes to wealth building? Because I'm not sure if I'm correct with this statement, but many times those are diametrically, or there's a dichotomy that's presented. Either you're in school or you're out of school and building wealth. Mm-hmm. So do you think they ever coincide in terms of building wealth in the school space or building wealth as you are in school? Is that even a possibility? Or is that just like a fanciful dream?
So I'm gonna maybe redefine the term or define the term wealth. Wealth, your personal wealth is not just your bank statement and what you have in your personal financial statement. Okay. So the biggest advice, which answers this question, I think, in my mind, based on my experience and what I've seen, is that if you're a student and you're in school today and you're learning a trade or a profession or some specialty, you're learning something that you're going to be able to apply, and then this skill you'll be able to then go take what you've learned, your knowledge, and take it to the marketplace and basically trade that knowledge for income and a lifestyle, right? I mean, that's why most people do it. But here's the thing, what you have to realize if you're a student is that a lot of people, when they finish school, that's literally the last bit of learning that they ever do. And unfortunately, what you learn in school can be very effective in a trade, or like, obviously you have to go to pharmacy school if you're going to be a pharmacist, so you have to do that. And I know pharmacists can do well financially, and it's a great career and all that. I know some, I have some friends that are. But what they don't teach you, and what I think you're doing here, which is awesome, is the bigger picture. And that is, hey, that's just one part of your overall life, right? And you want to take the opportunity to be a lifelong student on personal wealth, developing yourself in all areas, in your intellectual, in your physical, in your spiritual, in your emotional. Part of that is, you know, investing and learning about other things outside of your trade. In your trade, you could do that for the rest of your life if that's what you want to do, and more power to you. But a lot of people may work in a field for a number of years and say, well, hey, now I want to leverage this and do something else. And if you've been smart with your decisions by continuing to educate yourself and get around people that have done things that you want to do, maybe inside and outside your field, mm-hmm. then you grow, and as you be, then you will be able to do, and then you'll be able to have more. So the more you be, the more you can do, and the more you can have. Oh. A lot of people want to skip the be and the do and just get right to the have. And and so what they do is, David, they go out and they get in debt, and they come out. So you've been a student, you know, a starving student, let's say, for all these years, and now you're finally making a decent salary, right? You know, like, people are going to pay you money. And
oh, man. And
so what do? You go out and you buy a nice car, and you do all this, and you get the credit cards out. And that's the worst thing you can do. If you're going to do anything, my suggestion is put some money away. Even if you don't have a lot now, put it in your head. You know, be thinking about it, planning on it, talking about it. And then when you do get the salary, your first investment ought to be into a house or somewhere you can live and buy, because now you're going to get on the equity train and start creating wealth in real estate. And that will open up amazing opportunities down the road for additional investments, whether it's in real estate or other things, because now your net worth is growing, whether you're doing anything or not, because you've got to live somewhere. So you're going to rent something, you're going to pay somebody rent, and their rent's going to go up every single year, and you've got no control, and you got no equity, and you got no tax advantages. Or you can buy a place, and when you're buying a property to live in, the mortgage terms are great, the down payment terms are low, you don't have to have a lot of that, and particularly if you're a professional, there are programs. I mean, you can get in for almost no money down, and so now you've got this property that's going to grow. It will grow in value over time, and you will pay down the loan over time. But a lot of people go out and they buy the car, and then it puts them in a position where they can't afford to go buy the house. And then so now they're already behind the curve, and you may have student loans and things like that. So you've already got some debt maybe you've got to deal with. But don't go out and get a bunch of other debt. Educate yourself and build the wealth of value in yourself. Wow. And you'd be amazed what could happen in 5 or 10 years after the fact.
Wow, good. You know, be, do, then have. So identity, action, and then acquisition. That's very good. It's very good. So, you know, when I was learning about time management, because my parents made sure that I learned about time management from an early point in my career, and that has contributed to me being able to do the things that I've done so far, so early in my career. So when I was learning about time management, I learned the concepts of delegation and leverage. So delegating tasks to different people and leveraging people within your network to help you be more productive, basically. So I'm curious, how do those concepts interplay when it comes to money management? Because people say time is money, but I take it those concepts could be like, how do you use delegation when it comes to money management? How do you use leverage when it comes to money, or acquiring money, or being more productive to gain money? Where do you see those playing out, even in your career or your experiences? How have you used it?
Well, I would disagree on the popular saying that time is money.
Okay.
Money is money. Time is life.
Okay.
Right. So you're trading your life for money, and it's interesting. There's a verse in the Bible that says redeeming the time, and so this idea of redeeming your time, you can buy back your life or your time with money, and you know, you can get from here where I am in Virginia to Colorado, a lot of different ways. You can walk, you can ride a bike, you can drive, you can fly. And they all get you there. Mm-hmm. But they all get you there in different methodologies, but at different speeds and whatnot. So you could sort of, the analogy would be leverage. And so as an individual, we have a limited amount of time in our life, right? And so you got 24 hours in a day. I don't care how smart you are, or how gifted you are, or not, right? Same time, just like you learn time management. And by the way, your parents obviously were very, very wise people to really set you on that path, which is an advantage. So you learn leverage. And so there's a lot of ways to leverage. Like, for instance, simple one, like I don't cut my grass. I haven't cut my grass for decades. It's not because I don't like the smell of freshly mown lawns. It's not because I wouldn't mind getting out and getting a break and just like, oh, this is great. I feel like I accomplished something. You know, cut the grass looks great. But it's that hour or two that I could use to do something more effective with my time that's a higher value than something that, you know, just pushing a lawnmower, which anybody can do, mm-hmm. right? It's getting an assistant, you know, like in a business. So if you're a pharmacist, having an assistant that can do a lot of the things that the tasks that don't really require the level of education and decisioning that that a pharmacist has to do, but stuff that still has to get done, right? So you can train someone to do that and leverage your time and therefore maybe double your time. We have it in real estate too. That's why a lot of people like real estate investment, because for a small down payment, then you can leverage an asset that's much more valuable and take wow. advantage of appreciation. Mm-hmm. So for instance, if you were to buy, let's say you bought a $400,000 house.
Yeah, choose examples, very good.
Yeah, and you put down, let's say it's, you're buying it for yourself. Let's say you put down 5%, so 20,000, or maybe even no money, but let's just say 5%, $20,000. So you put down $20,000, right, on this $400,000 house. But if you look at the average appreciation ratio based upon area that you live in the house and everything, but let's just say 3 to 4%, we'll say 4% to make the math work or to make it easy. So a 4% appreciation on a $400,000 house is a $16,000 increase in the value of the property every year, compound. Okay. So wow. you invested 20 in the end of the year, you made 16. So you made $16,000 on a $20,000 investment. Well, multiply that over 10 years, and now this property might be worth, you know, $550,000, or I don't do the math in my head, but significantly more. You still only invested $20,000. So you leveraged a little bit, and you're able to leverage it versus putting $20,000 into the bank and getting a passbook savings rate, or even putting it into a stock, right? And let's say you can get yourself a 10% return, you know, which is not easy. You're still only going to get $2,000 a year return on that $20,000 investment because it's not leveraged.
Wow.
So a lot of people like real estate from that standpoint. And then taking it to another level, if you buy an investment property, like a lot of young professionals will hack this, where they'll buy their first house knowing it's not their dream house, and they get in it for very little down. And then a year or two later, they'll rent that house out and they'll go buy another house to live in. So they move to this other house, they've rented the first one. And then another year or two later, they do the same thing and they're continually sort of upgrading their lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, you've got this trail of 1, 2, 3, 4, however many houses that are being rented that are bringing in positive cash flow because mm-hmm. the renters are paying the mortgage. And oh, by the way, they're probably appreciating also in the 3 to 4 to 5% range every year. So now you might have $1 million worth of assets that are appreciating, but you got in it for very little money and somebody else is paying for it. So it's that's an example of leverage, you know, from a financial world. You can do it with options and things like that in the market too. And I'm not an expert there, so I'm not going to go there. But I know real estate. But anytime you can duplicate yourself or your efforts or energies through someone else or through some other technology, yeah. it's the way to go, because again, we only have 24 hours in a day, and there will come a time where most of your listeners will have families. If they don't have them now, they will want to spend time with their family and not working, 80, 100 hours a week, right? So you want to, but you want the lifestyle, and you want everything that, and you want to go on vacation. And so you want, your business or your income to continue to go. So that's kind of the idea of leverage, and you can do it with people, you can do it with assets, and you can do it like, I'll give you another example. So like the book, like you mentioned the book I wrote. So the book is leverage. So the book, people can go out and get the book that are interested in maybe buying the commercial space that they're running. Let's say you have a pharmacy. You're a pharmacist. You come out of school and you're working for a company, and you've done great there for 2-3 years. And you're like, hey, I'm going to start my own pharmacy here in town. And you go out and do that, and you're going to lease space for a few years, which is the right thing to do because you got to get your business going and profitable. But once you're going and profitable and you've had it going for a few years, you're like, okay, wow, now I'm spending all this money on rent. What if I own the building that my pharmacy was in? Because I've got to pay rent to somebody, and it's not that much different than owning your own home. And so I got this book out there that we haven't met, but you happen to find it on Amazon or whatever, and you read the book, you're like, oh, I didn't realize I could do this. And so you reach out to me or someone else who wrote a book or something. And so there's leverage of like, oh, it's working for me and I'm not there doing it.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, definitely get the book, folks. Get the book. Purchase the book. So yeah, as we start to wrap up, you host your own podcast. What led you to start your podcast? And the podcast is the Brick and Mortar Money Show Podcast. Start your podcast?
Yeah, Brick and Mortar Money Show Podcast. No, that's a great question, David. I love this. I love talking to people and engaging to people and learning and just highlighting people that are doing amazing things. Because again, I learn and people learn, and I think the more we can learn from each other, the better off we all are. Most of my clients and friends and the people I work with, kind of my tribe, are business owners and entrepreneurs and professionals, high performing professionals. And so our show is really geared around sort of the confluence of business ownership and creating wealth through property ownership. Because as you'll find, again, as your careers continue to grow and you guys start making a lot of money, you're going to want to do something with it that's productive. And so a lot of people, everyone's putting money in 401ks and all that. And that has its pluses and minuses for sure. But then a lot of people want real estate because they can taste it, touch it, feel it, see it. And in a lot of areas, from commercial to a lot of vacation homes, things like that, people doing all kinds of things. And so I felt like, well, this is a great place to sort of to learn myself and interview people in different areas of that space that could help inform all of us business owners on, what's working, what's not working, and just really how to be better. And back to one of the points I made earlier is to continue to grow, kind of like the reason you're probably doing your podcast, right? To grow and get smarter and more intelligent and meet new people. And someone told me a long time ago, and actually encouraged me to do it. And their line was, exposure brings opportunity, right? We're exposing ourselves to new things, right? I mean, why did you start yours? You've got a successful podcast.
Thank you. Yeah. So as we start to wrap up, the reason why I started this because several reasons. I started this during the pandemic in 2020. So the country was locked. I was in the Bahamas at the time with my family. The country was locked down. And I also was reading a book by MIT Press called Find Your Path. And I was like, wow. And the book was discussing like key people in science who won like the Hertz Fellowship, which is like a big fellowship in science, NSF Fellowship, or these like huge fellowships, and they're like presidents of this company and this type of thing. And I was like, wow. I was like, imagine if I could become a student of these types of people and not just make the classroom for myself, but expand the classroom so that it becomes a public forum.
Yeah,
so that I'm helping people as I help myself, It's a mutual beneficial opportunity, benefiting from the people and learning about them, their trajectories, their life stories, how they make decisions, how they strategize, like, and then take that information and make it publicly available. Because I'm all about equity and access with strategy, not just saying I want to make things equal or make opportunities, create opportunities to help people, but be strategic with it, and that's where this podcast came about. Like, for example, I'm gonna say this last thing and then we'll conclude. For example, people talk about getting into different academic institutions, right? But one strategy that people are not always aware of or not always trying to execute in their own career is many times those people do a research internship or some type of practical experience at the other university, get a letter of rec at that university for admission into a higher level program at the university that the internship at. So like do research, for example, do research at University X, even though you go to University B, mm-hmm. then you apply to University X to get into that university, and you have the letter of rec to support your application because of the experiences you've done. So that in itself is a strategy to progress in academia for different programs like grad school, med school, pharmacy school, all those others. So yeah, I completely agree. You know, Mr. Neil, I appreciate you sharing all these insights, you know, talking about financial management, wealth building, like real estate. So any final words before we conclude?
I would just say that this has been a lot of fun, David. I appreciate the opportunity to be on your show. And, you know, if you're speaking to, I'm sure the brightest of them out there, people that are pursuing higher level degrees that are disciplined in science and in medicine, it's a tough place to be, super rewarding. And I would say, again, I would just underscore, don't stop your learning when you walk across and get your, you know, you get that final degree and you start working. Now's the time to start embracing new areas maybe that you haven't had time to pursue before, because you already have the wherewithal and the intelligence to really understand these things. And by doing it and aligning with the right people, there's no telling how far you can go in your future and your life.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Thanks again, Mr. Neil, for joining me. I really appreciate it. Okay, welcome to the New Student Pharmacist Podcast Experience. It is so good to have you listening in today. My guest today is Mr. Jalen Harrison. Wow, this is an interesting experience because I met Jalen recently. Well, we attend the same university, Howard University, and we also attend the same church, Grace Covenant Church at Capitol Hill. So just a quick introduction about Jalen. Jalen has served as a Future Leaders Fellow with the African American Mayors Association. He has served as an intern for Congresswoman Sheila Sherfilis McCormick. He served as a political intern for the Emerson Collective, and he also served as a legislative intern for Congresswoman Jennifer McKellen. So he's a darn good Brit. And you know, Jalen is also headed off to law school soon. So it's definitely a treat, I would say, to have Jalen on the podcast today. Jalen, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, David. I want to just thank you for having me. This is exciting.
Yeah, this is exciting. So what inspired you to pursue a career in law, particularly in choosing UVA Law School for your graduate studies after completing your time, or since you have completed your time at Howard?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, law was always something that I kind of wanted to pursue. I think when you're young and you're argumentative, people, you know, try to point you in that direction. But the reality is I came to Howard with goals of, you know, doing political work and really uplifting the Black community. There were some systemic issues that I saw that I was hoping to address, and I'm still hoping to address, and I thought Howard was the best place to do that. And at my time at Howard, both in the classroom as well as during the internships I was doing, I just saw the way that many of the issues that I wanted or hoping to solve were rooted in legal structures and legal barriers. And again, in those internships, whether it was at, you know, the congressional internships I did or at Emerson Collective, which was a philanthropic organization, the people mm-hmm. who I most kind of bonded with, the ones who was doing the work that I found the most interesting, both intellectually in terms of the actual material that they were studying and doing, as well as some of the practical implications of the work they were doing, was the lawyers. And that really solidified for me that law school was the right path for me, and that it was the right path for me to go straight through immediately going from undergrad to UVA law. In terms of choosing what law school, you know, I cast a wide net. I applied to a total of 12 law schools. Many of them were, you know, recognized as some of the best law schools in the country. I kind of had a, you know, short, not a short list per se, but, you know, I kind of knew what type of law I wanted to do. I knew the type of law school I would need to go to do that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, after getting the acceptances, you kind of had to take into account a few things. The first is which is what network, what school has lawyers in some of the prominent, like, civil rights organizations that are in the country. You know, your NAACP Legal Defense Fund, your Southern Poverty Law Centers. Next, I had to think about, like, what would the cost be, right? And after I took that into account, and the last thing being culture, when I went to go visit some of these schools, where did I feel most at home? UVA really, I don't know, just really appealed to me. Maybe it's because I'm from Virginia and that's home to me. Okay. But UVA was, it's an exceptional law school, and I'm excited to study there this fall.
Okay, dude, that's good, man. I'm happy for you, Ray. Congratulations, you are doing well. So I want to dig deep into that. So what creates or what allowed you to know that that was home for you? I know you said it's another home for you, but what aspect of the culture? Mm-hmm. Because what you're pointing to, from my understanding, is also pointing to this concept of belonging, you know?
So, absolutely.
And so culture and belonging, how they overlap. So what aspects of the culture were you looking for as you were trying to find a university that you think would be a good fit for you, or where you would belong, or where the culture felt at home?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'll say it starts early in the admissions process, right? Where, like, I got a good feel for the culture of the schools that I was going to, that I applied to and that I potentially would attend based off, you know, what was the interview like? That was kind of the first step. Oh, and when I interviewed with UVA, with their director of admissions, a woman named Roseanne Ibanez, I believe I'm pronouncing her last name, right? It was just a really great and kind environment. I had met Roseanne about a year prior at this minority pre-law conference that was held on William & Mary Law's campus. And immediately as I joined the interview, she remembers me. You know, she's talking about how she's happy to see me again. And it's just, you know, displaying a level of kindness. I always say there's moments when interviews change into conversations, yeah, right? Yeah. Where it's no longer a situation where it's this, you know, power dynamic of somebody just feeding me questions. But we're just communicating with each other. So that kind of really set the tone. But at the end of the day, you know, you have to go, in my personal opinion, what I would suggest to other people who decide to pursue any advanced degree, you want to then go to the campus and really see how are the students living. So I go to UVA Law for a tour. I actually missed Admitted Students Day. I was working at the time. And I told Roseanne that I'd be there. And she set up a lunch with me and the Black Law Student Association, also known as the BOLSA. After I finished the tour, I'm with the BOLSA. We're at this hotel right next to law school. And they're just, everybody who was at that table was just incredibly honest about their experiences at UVA. The things that they loved about the school, as well as some of the things that they thought it could potentially be doing better. It was overwhelmingly positive. But then even after I, you know, got through my specific UVA law questions, I mean, at the end of the day, they just cared about me as a human. Wow. Everybody who's been in this position, the reality is that, like, we all, for the most part, have multiple schools that we could select. And, you know, you of all people know this. I mean, you did advanced degrees. At a certain point, it's you know, the quality of the education, regardless of where you choose, is going to be quite similar. So at the end of the day, it's where you're going to be the right fit. And, you know, they understood some of the other schools I was debating with. Many of them had also debated between attending those schools. And the vibe I got from all of them was, you know, we would love for you to be here. We like you. We think you'll succeed here. But hey, any of these schools that you're going to go to, you're going to succeed, and we'll be happy for you, and let's stay in touch regardless. Mm-hmm. Right. So it didn't feel like they were selling me. It just felt more like if this feels like home to you, come. And at the end of the day, I think that level of community that was at UVA Law, especially with the BOLSA, which is where I'm hoping to be tapped into, was really the not selling point, but really the
point that convinced you.
Exactly.
I agree with you completely, you know, because even for myself, I got accepted basically to every school that I applied to or that I interviewed at for pharmacy school. And, you know, for me at Howard, you know, it's interesting dynamic because it was not just about rankings, it was not just about all I can gain, but I also thought about what can I give to the environment, you know? Mm-hmm. how do I see myself being able to grow in the environment? What areas, or just to use a little bit of technical terms, what value proposition that the school has aligns with the values that I have for myself? Which value propositions for that school aligns with my personal value, professional value propositions? So how do I see myself being able to bring value or gain value? So vice versa. Yeah, dude, that's good. And also the thing of belonging, dude, that's very powerful. Because, you know, I've heard someone say, and this is actually a person of faith, she said, you know, the moment you realize that you belong somewhere, you are able to come up with strategies and work through even the challenges, because you know at the end of the day that you belong where you are. I mean, it's so powerful. So how do you plan to balance the demanding workload of law school with other aspects of your life to ensure a holistic perspective on your career and personal well-being? What do you plan to do? How are you thinking about it now? Because you're about to embark. Yeah. Pharmacy school. It takes some time. You have some coming to Jesus moments every now and again, but that's all right. That's a part of the process. So, what would you say is your plan or strategy for self-care? Let me make this practical. So, what do you say is your plan for self-care? What would you say is your plan for like academic achievement? And like, you know, certain people go into these programs trying to get 4.0. Some people don't. Some people just want to do what they do, enjoy the program and get okay enough grades so that they're able to progress through the program. So what do you see a mix looking like?
Yeah, you know, I talked to many friends who have finished law school about this exact thing. I mean, you know, law school is one of the more rigorous advanced degrees. It's 3 years. And it's pretty much suggested that you need to treat it like a job. It shouldn't, getting, you know, a side job during law school is quite difficult. And some schools don't even allow you to do so, right? So it's very much a time where I'm gonna have to be committed. You know, to answer your question, the short answer is I actually don't know fully, but
all right.
When I don't know something, I go to my mentors, I go to advisors, and I just ask, hey, what did you do? And the overwhelming advice I got was, and what I've seen is, hey, like, again, this is gonna be a daunting task, but like, treat it like a job. You know, a job, you work a job 9 to 5, 9 to 6, but once you get off that job, you need to take your breather, you need to make sure that you're still maintaining those same habits that you did in undergrad due to law school, that, the, you know, the habits that led to success there, you need to bring that with you in a law school. So I'm gonna live a pretty disciplined life. I mean, I see myself, I'm somebody who loves just academia in general. I think scholarship is incredibly fascinating. So in terms of like, the actual material of law, that's what most excites me. And you know, I'm not worried about delving into that at all. That's just, I love to learn. That's the kind of person I am. But yeah, I think one of the things I'm gonna have to force myself to take breaks. I'm gonna need to learn how to better formulate a work-life balance, because, you know, in undergrad, you know, you have a lot more time in undergrad than I think people get credit for. I mean, most of my time was spent outside the classroom, you know, reading textbooks, reading material. But even outside of that, you know, you could still do a whole bunch of clubs. You read what I did earlier. I was able to do most of those internships I did. Two of those were like during the semester. Like it was, you know, I was able to balance that. That's not necessarily going to be possible for law school. Or if it is possible, it's going to be incredibly difficult. So, I mean, that was a long answer, but the reality is I'm probably just going to call past lawyers who went through law school and say, hey, I'm dealing with this. What should I do? And get their advice. That's probably the best way. How do you balance everything?
Well, I'm going to tell you right now, but before I tell you to how I balance everything. Well, for me, before I get to me, you know, my brother's actually a lawyer. He was trained in the UK. So one of the things I've noticed with my brother, he has mastered the art of taking breaks. He knows how to take breaks. Like, he played rugby while he was in law school, so he really pushed and really did that a lot. My brother Wolf Ferguson, he continues to play rugby to this day, and he's been finished with law school probably from like 2017, 2018. So, you know, I think finding a hobby, and that's something that how do I maintain balance?
Mm-hmm.
Balance for me, it ebbs and it flows. I'm gonna be very honest with you, it ebbs and it flows. You know, I have set priorities for myself. Like self-care is a priority, like sleep is a priority, nutrition is a priority, community is a priority. Going to church for me is a part of my self-care, to be quite frank with you. So that That's a priority for me. So my self-care is a priority. My academic, my scholarship is a priority. However, mm-hmm. I know how far to push with that. You know, this is degree 3 for me. So how I see this is a little different from degree 1 or degree 2, you know? And I know what's required for me to progress to the next stage. And I'm learning what's going to be required for me to get into the other areas I want to get into, like either clubs or academic societies or internships. So I know how much to push and I know when to stop, you know? That's one thing I learned recently, probably in grad school, you know? After you've done enough, you can stop. And that's okay. That's a very powerful concept that I learned, you know? People who are very driven, you have to remind yourself that, and I have to remind myself too of this too, that, you know, it's good to work, it's good, but it's also good to rest. Even Jesus rested. So too we, you know? So we as well should rest as well. So yeah, man, that's how I do it. But I'll be honest with you, some days I'm not as balanced as I should be, but it is what it is.
Can I add something? Do you mind if I add something?
Go ahead, dude. This is my guest today.
Yeah. I had a professor who I think, you know, talked about the concept of work-life balance in a way that really impacted me and that I really related to. You know, typically we have this idea that work-life balance means, you know, you have these set hours where you work, 9 to 5 or 9 to 6, whatever it is. And then outside of that, you're not doing any work. You're, you know, attending to your family, you're attending to your kids, whatever you need to do, right? Mm-hmm. But the professor is like, you know, and do you understand this is a political guy in D.C.? He's like, that for me, work-life balance, it's about moments where maybe a week I'm working a lot, but then that next week I might need to take some time off to attend to the things I need to attend to, or maybe a month I was grinding really hard. And you know, I found that when I was preparing for the LSAT, and again, I think anybody who had to prepare for any admission status understands that, you know, these tests take a lot of work. It's really time commitment. You know, in that season of my life, I was waking up at 5 a.m. to study because that's what was necessary. I didn't have any other time. So maybe I was going to bed early to make sure I could do that. But the moment, you know, it was a weekend or the moment where that wasn't necessary, I had to, you know, reel myself back in and be like, okay, we're going to take this entire Sunday off or whatever, like whatever was necessary. And this is the interesting thing I found. And of course, this is anecdotal. But when I was studying for the exam, there was a moment where, and this happened very early on during my study period, where I was like, okay, I need to study every day for 2 to 3 hours every day. That's what it takes, right? And that was misguided. And the summer came around and I had friends and, my friends were in the city and I decided, okay, I actually need to take like some days off a couple of weeks where I could just, you know, spend time with friends and enjoy life. And the interesting, I found that my scores on practice tests increased when I took that time to get that mental break. Just a little something to add about that work-life balance aspect we were talking about.
With you. And I've discussed this concept with probably about 50 plus people on this podcast. Some people phrase it as work-life balance. Some people call it work-life integration. Some people call it work-life fit. You know, it depends. And also it depends on the person too, you know. Yes, there are some standards for balance. There are some absolute, there are some like basic things like self-care. You know when your self-care is out of whack. But there's balance for, it depends on the person. One person may have 6 kids, a demanding job, and a spouse. One person might be single. You know, balance for them looks different. Looks very different. And I think we have to be flexible with that, our definition of that, even though we have some baseline parameters for that. So, can you highlight some of your most impactful achievements or contributions during your time at Howard? What made Howard stand out to you, or what makes it stand out to you as you transition on to UVA? What has been one of your most compelling or enjoyable experiences at Howard? I'm new here, but I have a number of experiences I could talk about. So what has been really enjoyable for you?
Yeah, Howard is it's such a special institution. You know, I won't lie, there are, of course, with any school, there are problems. I feel like Howard's problems get highlighted often. In my personal, I think it's a little bit too much to get highlighted, and it kind of overshadows some of the brilliance. and beauty of the campus. But to answer your question, Howard is unique for a couple reasons. First, of course, it's HBCU, historically Black college slash university. It's arguably the most prominent HBCU. I don't say that because I go there. I am a little biased, but I still think that to be true.
Nothing wrong with that.
But because of that, and because it's kind of known as this place that has a large alumni base, who has really prominent African-American leaders throughout history who have attended the institution, mm-hmm. you get a self-selection of students who are just really passionate about a variety of different topics and really smart, really, really willing to do the work in order to excel in their coursework. Mm-hmm. And similarly, you get professors too, mm-hmm. many of them who specialize in, you know, multiple disciplines, but also have like an Africana lens with respect to the discipline. I studied political science and I minored in philosophy. And, you know, some of the most intelligent Black people in the world are here, truly, teaching.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So because of that, you know, you get exposed to scholarship and disciplines that just are not available at other universities. And the example I like to bring up is, you know, I studied under one of my philosophy professors, Dr. Patrick Gooden. And, you know, he kind of was one of the earlier adoptees of like Africana philosophy. And you get to study that at Howard. You don't get to study that at other institutions. Mm-hmm. In terms of experiences, it's great. I think, here's what I said, the Howard, again, alumni base in the name really holds a lot of weight, that I found that if somebody went to Howard, they really will go out of the way to be able to help you. And mm-hmm. during my time, during my time here, I was part of the, incidentally, I'm part of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, also known as the NAACP. I was on the Political Action Committee. I joined my sophomore year as a member. My junior year, I became the engagement coordinator for that committee. And then my senior year with them right now, I co-chaired the committee with a dear friend named Saida Webb. And really in my junior year, you know, my entire goal was to be able to leverage some of the relationships and connections I developed during my previous internships and kind of bring that over to Howard University and expose our student base to those people so that they can understand what it looks like to be, you know, to have a career in politics, right? And when I was a fellow with the African American Mayors Association, I was fortunate to speak to a whole bunch of mayors, some of the more notable, such as, you know, Mayor Eric Adams in New York City, as well as some lesser known mayors. But by far, you know, the mayor who I think had the most impact on me as well as the other fellows is a woman named Dawn Patterson Howard, who represents Mount Vernon, New York. He also happens to be a Howard alumni, right? So after my fellowship ended, you know, I really wanted to have an elected official, you know, speak to the members of our committee. So I just, you know, cold emailed Mayor Patterson Howard, and she responded really quickly to me. She was like, you know, I would love to speak, and we were able to set up a Zoom call. And, you know, it was just a time where she was able to feed into the students at Howard and just give them advice and wisdom and insight about, one, what does it mean to be a public servant? What does it mean to give back to your community? And, you know, it wasn't the most impactful event. There might have been 10 or 12 people on the call, right? It wasn't a scenario where it was 100 or 200. But despite the fact that there was only 10 or 12 people on that call, I know that they got something out of that call.
Yeah.
That the information that Mayor Sean Patterson Howard gave to us was useful and will be useful to them. Right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that, right, like that is one of my favorite Howard stories, and one that I shared with you just to show just how not necessarily easily accessible, easy accessible and helpful our alumni base is. And really the fact that you can reach out to anyone. And, you know, that's one story. I have many more, as I'm sure you do, of just how the university has championed students, but also how the alumni base has been made sure to continue to give back. And, you know, that's why I love Howard. That's why I want my brother to come here. He's young, he's 14. I'm trying to get him to come here. But I'm always happy when I see another person attending Howard University.
Yeah, I agree with you. So, you know, you made the point, sometimes the negative gets highlighted more than the positive. Yeah, you know, you have to keep the right perspective. I think gratitude and, you know, having a driven, data driven outlook allows you to see the positive for what it is, you know, and see the issues for what they are too. But, you know, even with issues, you can complement the change in the narrative and complement to solving them. And then you said some other things I want to point out. Can you explain what's the Africana lens?
Oh, so this is drink. Yeah. I maybe shouldn't have just thrown out a word without describing what I meant by it. When I'm talking about Africana philosophy, when people say Africana, just in general, often they're talking about, you know, like all Black people throughout the diaspora, right? Oh, so okay. It's not solely attached to the continent of Africa, it's just wherever you go. There's a lot of work with respect to Africana philosophy. Somebody who's incredibly prominent in that field is Dr. Lewis Gordon, who hasn't had a textbook dedicated to the work. But before getting too theoretical, it's kind of this idea that there's a connection to a certain degree amongst Black people as a response to just, you know, the experiences of oppression that many people go through post the colonization of Africa. Like that inciting event leads to some level of connectivity. This is not to say that all Black people are the same or that Black people are modern. I'm very clear in what I'm saying. And I would advise people to go read up on African philosophy if possible. But so when I say that, like, Howard has an Africana lens, a great example I like to bring up is in the political science department, there is a political theory and there's a Black political theory. These are two separate classes. And I took political theory and I wouldn't be able to tell you the difference between the political theory and the Black political theory, because so much of the text that we're reading is Black scholars speaking from a Black perspective.
Yeah. You know, it's a lot. Dude, this is the thing, you know, and I'm just going to say, you know, Black people have contributed in so many unique ways to the advancement of science, mathematics, and other fields. And, you know, we hear about it, even music. You hear about it later on, like hundreds of years later, oh, this is actually done by a person of color. This is actually done by a Black person. You know, Katherine Johnson, you know, the mathematician, the woman mathematician, she did those calculations for the flight trajectory by hand. Can you imagine that? David Blackwell, the Black mathematician, all of these big, huge players. And, you know, unfortunately, because of bias, we hear about their stories later on and they don't get the recognition, or they get recognition at a delayed interval from a delayed standpoint. But, you know, it is what it is. We just have to work the situation and work the system as best possible. But yeah, the last thing I'll say before we continue in this conversation, you know, you talk about your mentors. It's so good to have good mentors, dude. You know, having people who can, like, speak directly into your situation and also who respond quickly to emails. Because sometimes, like, my mentors, like, three big players outside of my parents, three mentors I have are Dr. Langdon, Dr. Bayer, and Dean May. I mean, Chancellor May. You know, they're some of the most phenomenal, down-to-earth, hard-working people I've met outside of my family. So yeah, dude, how do you plan to foster? As we start to wrap
up, David, do you mind if I add one more thing? Actually, I want to mention something to what you were saying.
You're the star, because star.
Yeah, you brought up mentors, and you brought up just people who've helped you along the way. And I think this is important to the question you asked previously about the Howard experience and, you know, what I've thought about this. You know, somebody who I am incredibly grateful for outside of, like, my family, but on the university, is a man named Dr. Brandon Hogan, who he's in the philosophy department. He went to Howard University for undergrad. He went to Harvard Law. And he also went to, you know, University of Pitt for his PhD in philosophy. And, you know, he's my favorite professor. I'll say that publicly. But he's the reason why, one, I've learned so much from him just being just studying under him, the way he teaches philosophy. He's very analytical, having to explicitly craft arguments and make sure that they're both valid and sound was very beneficial for me, not just in terms of, you know, writing and reading, et cetera, but also, like, for the law school admissions test alone, like, that was a beneficial skill. Without that class, I don't know how well I would have done an exam. But more so, when I was, preparing my written materials for law school, he was the guy who I would go to have him read through it. And I remember I sent him a personal statement, and the first time he reads it, he's like, in like corporate speak, but I'm going to paraphrase, you know, this ain't it. Like it's okay. It's not what it needs to be. Okay. I sent another draft. Mm. This is better, but it's still not there. Wow. I sent another draft. Let's have a meeting. Go to my office after class. I said, okay. I go to his office and we spend time just sketching out, like, you know, getting to the heart of why do I want to go to law school? What do I want the admissions team to know about me? Mm-hmm. And how do I make that a compelling narrative, right? Mm-hmm. So I do that. I send it to him again and then he continues to get notes. And eventually it reached the point where it was good, where it's something I would be proud to be able to submit to these schools, right? And I owe a lot of, I think, my success with respect to getting into law schools on the fact that, like, he just took the time to read my materials and feed into me. And it's not just him. I could mention, like, Professor Jay Stewart, who's also at the university, who's been super helpful. A whole bunch of professors who just take the time when they don't need to do that. That's not part of their job. Their job is to teach you, and you can go to office hours if you need to. They don't need to spend extra time going through your law school materials, but they do. And I think that's something that's really special about Howard.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. You know, I can think of some professors that I'm starting to interface with, considering this is my first year. But even before I get to them, like, some professors I can name a few, like Dr. Aldithi, Dr. Turner. One of my favorite, I won't state who is my exact favorite, but one of my favorite professors for pharmacy is Dr. Deshner. Simon Deshner. He's my favorite professor. My favorite expression I use is, let's be clear. Be clear in your mind. Be clear in your mind. So as you're doing the calculation, be clear in your mind. I'm like, yeah, I need to be clear. So I thoroughly enjoy his class. But yeah, it's a similar story. My dad was the one who actually helped me with my pharmacy essay. My dad's a physician. Mm. Wolf Ferguson. He did the same thing to me when I gave him the essay. He was like, David, this ain't ready. Like, this ain't what we should be talking about. David, this ain't ready. He said, I would not let you into my pharmacy school with this essay. You need to rewrite this. And he told me that straight up, and I'm glad he did. Because that allowed me, you know, to do a quick check, you know, check how I was writing, check my perspectives, really go back to the drawing board and really put in the time to write a good essay. And that complemented, I know for a fact that complemented to me being able to make the strides I was able to make in my admission, in the admissions. Of course, by God's grace, but the work, you have to put in the work. So my dad helped me tremendously. And also my mom, dude, to this day, I still send scholarship essays to my family members.
Wow.
I still do it, because it's one thing to read an essay and to think you have it together. It's another thing to share your work with someone else and they pull your feet back down to earth and say, you need to fix this, you know? And even, dude, my thesis, I could talk about my thesis, pardon me. I'll be brief, but my thesis, dude, with my thesis advisor was so particular, down to the spaces after the periods, down to the spaces between the oxygen and the negative sign, down to the formatting of the tables, down to the italics, and everything should be uniform in its italics, down to the references, it should be alphabetized, down to the structures, and make sure the biosynthetic pathways are accurate. And if you can't show them an accuracy, shorten them and show what you can in an accurate way. You know? Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, dude, as we conclude, what advice do you have for those wanting to pursue law school or wanting to come to Howard? What advice does Jalen, my recently found buddy from Howard and from Grace Covenant, what advice does he have for them?
Yeah, I have a deep love for education. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, everybody should always be learning. You should be reading books, you should be listening to podcasts, any way you can pursue wisdom is important. With respect to law school, one of the things that really benefited me at Howard was, you know, a flip kind of switched for me early on, where, you know, you first get to university and the goal is, I just want to get A's. I just want to get A's, do well. My goal kind of changed as I pursued my studies further. Really, what I wanted to do is I wanted to learn as much as I can, and I wanted to submit work that not only I was proud of, but also that my professors could respect. And when you do that, you know, you will also get A's, but you'll get a lot more too, you know? And I think for the student who wants to, one, it's in Howard. If you do want to come here, this is a great place to be. I highly recommend it. But when you get here, you need to work. When you get here, you need to feed back into the school itself, and you need to, you know, do what you can in order to, you know, further your goals, whatever that end goal would be. Mm-hmm. If someone wants to do law school, to give you practical advice, I mean, two incredibly important aspects of law school is your GPA and your LSAT score. They're not everything. I want to be very clear, they're not everything, but they're just two big parts. You're also going to make sure you, you know, have some experience, maybe do some internships, do some clubs, figure out why you want to go to law school and how you can be a good fit for that school. Mm-hmm. But with respect to the GPA, again, you want to put your best foot forward during your studies and make sure you're getting a high GPA, because you know, the schools, we're seeing grade inflation happen. And if you look at, for example, GPA medians at law schools, even 10 years ago, they're very different than what they are now. They're much higher now than they were 10 years ago, right? And with the LSAT, I think the LSAT, it's a difficult exam. It's an exam that I actually really do appreciate, because it takes a long time, or at least for me, to have gotten good at it, or to improve. And, you know, you could look at it two ways. You can look at it as, oh man, I have to take this hard exam. That's unfortunate. Maybe I don't want to put in the work. Or you can look at it as an opportunity for you to kind of separate yourself from other people who are also getting into the same schools that you're trying to get in. So I think the LSAT is one of the best investments you can make. You know, if you have the ability to pay for a course or get a subscription to like a LSAT platform, I used a platform called LSAT Demon. I highly recommend you do that. Because even 2 or 3 or 4 point improvement is going to, you know, jump you in front of thousands of applicants. And if it's the case that you do not have the finances to do so, there's a couple of options. Khan Academy has a free LSAT resource that I would recommend if you can't do anything. But also, a lot of these platforms offer fee waivers for people who are under certain, you know, economic thresholds. And I would just do your research and look into that. But yeah, those are my main advice is one: basically, take your study seriously. And always pursue knowledge. And I think you really can't go wrong if you do those two things.
Yeah, man, this is good. This is good. Well, Jaylen, thanks again for joining me today. It was so good to have you on.
Thank you.
Okay, Isaiah Swan. It is so good to have you as a guest today. So Isaiah Swan is
Thank you for having me.
Yes. Isaiah Swan is a student in the medical sciences training program and cell and developmental biology graduate program at the University of Virginia. Originally from Marietta, Georgia, Isaiah completed a degree in neuroscience at the University of Texas at Dallas and a postgraduate at the Warren Center for Neuroscience Drug Discovery at Vanderbilt before arriving at UVA in 2021. Broadly, he is interested in neurology and expanding our understanding of basic cellular processes in neurons, such as how elements of the neuronal cytoskeleton contribute to axon pathfinding and proper synapse formation. While passionate about research and medicine, he believes it's important to lead a fulfilled life outside of work. Swan enjoys spending his free time sampling local restaurants with friends, making music, watching reality TV shows, and exercising. So, wow, I have Isaiah Swan, MPhD student, and one of the students represented on the NCAA Board of Governors. This is definitely an honor and a treat. So as we get started, what have been your long-standing interests in the field of science?
Yeah, absolutely. So kind of as long as I can remember, I've been very interested in knowing how things work. And I think for me, that ended up really kind of manifesting in middle school when I started going out to summer camps. And it was a science-specific summer camp. And I really wanted to know, like, you know, what is neuroscience? How is science done in the brain, in the spinal cord, in the nerves around the body? How does that work? And, you know, from a very young age, I was very interested in these questions. And that's kind of followed me, obviously, to this point. And so I would say my long-standing interests are, for the most part, really in neuroscience and, you know, how do neurons actually function? How do they, you know, find their correct synaptic partners? Like, how do they make their connections? How are they injured in different disease states? So for me, I grew up kind of with a number of neurological diseases in my proximity with different family members having those things. And I wanted to know kind of how that works. And you know, as I got older and studied in these classes, I really started to realize that for the most part, we don't really have a super great handle on the origin of a lot of these diseases. And so that's kind of my, my interest just broadly is understanding, you know, how these disease processes work. And then eventually, I'd like to kind of,
the treatment,
you know, contribute to, contribute to treatments.
That's good. So the words they use, you can correct me if I'm wrong, because you're the MD-PhD student, I'm the PharmD student. So the word they use is, in terms of origin, is etiology, correct? And then in terms of unknown etiology, is idiopathic. So yeah, I did my master's thesis on cardiolipin's role in neurodegenerative diseases. I'll be happy to discuss that as we progress throughout this. So how do you maintain view of the bigger picture in your career and in your life in general? How do you keep perspective when you encounter challenges?
Yeah, absolutely. And that can be very difficult. And it was something that was really difficult for me, especially as I, entered the final stages of undergrad, and then also during my first year of medical school. It was really difficult for me to kind of see that big picture because I was so bogged down with classes and, like, you know, learning various processes, like where do T cells come from, like that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, immunology is very, 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 very vast. Yeah.
Right. And so for me, it was so difficult, you know, to look up and look around me. I'm blessed to have a really great family that, you know, even when I was having a very difficult time, just kind of reaching out to them, and just taking time away from my studies to call them, they would be reaching out to me. And I think that, you know, that's one, like, critical way that I really kind of helped, you know, maintain that bigger view, because they're my why, right? Like, they're why I do what I do, why fundamentally I'm interested in these diseases. And so for me, you know, reaching out to family, talking to them whenever, especially whenever I'm going through something difficult, that's sort of how I kind of maintain that kind of bigger picture, view.
Yeah, so relationship. I completely agree with that, because think I would even venture to say that reaching out to family members and friends and social relatives is a part of self-care. And I think self-care is very important, because no one else is going to care for you per se. You have to care for you.
Absolutely.
As best as you know how. So
absolutely.
How have you been adaptive and creative in the field of science? You talk about your passion for neurology. So what particular diseases strike your interest? Are you along the path of neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, Boston's, ALS, all those others, or MS, or are you along the path?
And what I mean by that is there are a lot of basic cellular processes that go awry due to factors that, for the most part, we don't really understand very well. And I'm interested in understanding those factors in all these different diseases, whether that be Parkinson's disease, Huntington's disease, which has a genetic component, right? Multiple sclerosis, right? All of these things. And so I think, you know, generally I'm very interested in all of these kind of neurodegenerative diseases, but I'm also very interested in concussion. So I think you mentioned that I have a role on the NCAA Board of Governors, which is one of the, if not the highest governing body in the association. And I've been trying to figure out ways, you know, to kind of synergize my love for sport with, you know, my passion for research. And I've been thinking a lot about, you know, how to do that on the medical side and on the research side. And one thing that is huge in sports right now, especially, is concussion and traumatic brain injury. And it turns out that intersects very nicely with what I study, which are intermediate filaments in neurons and sort of how those processes might be affected and contribute to pathologies following a traumatic brain injury, or could contribute to recovery following traumatic brain injury. So that's sort of my kind of broad interest in the field of neuroscience and neurology. And I also think that kind of helps me to stay really adaptive and also creative. It's really just looking at the different areas of my life and seeing where I can find common ground to help kind of synergize in those areas and help kind of push the field forward wherever I can.
I feel like I'm being inspired if I talk to you. This is good. So, what have been your most effective and impactful ideas to date? What ideas did you say you have contributed to, or you have helped to create or start? What would you say is one idea or some ideas that you think have been effective and impactful, or that you've been told about, even when it comes to your learning in medical school?
Yeah, I think, one thing, and I don't know that this might be kind of a tangential answer to the question, because I wouldn't necessarily say that I've had a really hugely impactful idea yet in science. But, one thing that, I always like hearing from my classmates in med school and in different research classes is that I ask kind of good questions, or questions that make people think about stuff. I do appreciate that. I appreciate hearing that, because I think it's important that, that we all think about sort of the why underlying a lot of the information that we learn, if that makes sense. Kind of questioning all of the things that we hear about and that we learn in a classroom on a slide. I think it's just important to kind of sit back and ask those questions. And so that's kind of, I would say that's one way that I've been kind of impactful, or have had kind of impactful ideas, just by asking questions. But obviously I'm very early on in my career. I wouldn't necessarily say that I've had a crazy impactful idea, although I'm chasing down kind of some leads right now, as far as my research goes, that could be impactful if it works out, but obviously it's way too early to know. So
yeah, and I was encouraging, I don't know what the project is on. What's your project on?
So currently I study intermediate filaments in neurons, and intermediate filaments are named that way because they fall in size between actin or microfilaments and microtubules, which are kind of the larger filaments that everybody really seems to care about. The interesting property that sets intermediate filaments apart from actin and microtubules is that they have a plethora of genes dedicated to their formation, and owing to these various genes, there are multiple isoforms that really each cell will express, multiple different versions of these proteins that different cells will express. And we don't exactly know why, but we do know that they do something. And so that's kind of where my project falls. It's figuring out of the intermediate filament proteins that are expressed in neurons, which ones are present when, during development of the neuron, and also what are they doing? And obviously that's a huge, huge question, but that's what I'm trying to answer through my work currently.
That's very interesting, dude. The power of differentiation, eh? How cell differentiation.
Yeah, yeah.
How different cells have different responsibilities, so the proteins function in different ways, even if they may come from the same gene, or they may be part of it. So, right. How do you find the right environment to thrive scientifically and intellectually? You are a very outgoing young person, and I thought it was very commendable to see the progress that you're making. So how do you find the right environment for yourself?
Yeah, thank you. To kind of rewind, my very first experience in research was in Weinschenker Lab at Emory University in 2015. 2015 at Emory, and I was a high school student doing summer research, and it was amazing. But I had a really, really great mentor, and I think that made all the difference for me. He really fostered a very there's a great environment that was very supportive, allowed me to fail, fail forward, take lessons from the failures that I made. And so kind of, starting with that experience, moving forward, the various different labs that I joined, I tried to look for, where were there solid mentors who would allow me to, as you said, fail forward, and ultimately, be successful in studying what I want to study and learning how to do good science, because that's the stage that I'm at right now, right? Is learning how to do good science.
Yeah, dude, and, good.
Yeah, and so for me, I was a little fortunate because owing to some of my kind of undergrad, basically owing to my schedule, I had to, do summer kind of internships away from my university, and have sort of shorter research experiences.
Uh-huh.
And because of that, I got to experience so many different lab cultures. And so, from each of those experiences, I just grabbed the little parts that I liked. And mm-hmm. I carried that with me and looked for a lab that had something like that. And I've been very blessed to end up in a lab, the Winkler Lab here at the University of Virginia, that is just incredibly supportive, has fantastic people, and ultimately allows me to thrive in many different ways.
Yeah, I'm afraid of this because I feel like I'm being motivated to continue with what I'm doing. So yeah, dude, this is good. So how do you maintain a balanced life given all your responsibilities and accomplishments? A better way to put this would be, how do you maintain work-life integration? You have a lot of responsibilities on your plate. I think it's commendable of you doing them well, but how do you maintain work-life integration?
Yeah, I think that's a tough one. I feel like I have ebbs and flows where I feel very, very balanced, and then there are other times where I feel like I have no balance at all, and I have like no control over my schedule, and it can be tough. I think I think a huge kind of piece when things are working for me is that I feel like I have control over my time, as far as when I am doing something, I don't allow myself to get interrupted by my various other responsibilities, right? I'm putting all of my attention into that one thing until it's done. And then I'm shifting my priority to something else. And I'm doing that task, and then I'm done. And then, of course, the biggest thing is really just making sure that you're giving yourself enough rest, right? I think that that's key for balance, whether that's sleep or just generally taking breaks and time off to do things that kind of energize you and feed you. So I think, when things are working for me, those are kind of the keys. But, I think I'd be lying to you if I said that I feel like I have a super balanced life.
Okay, Isaiah, so what has been some of the most beneficial advice you have received?
Yeah, I think kind of going back to something I alluded to earlier, I always wondered, how people were so good at multitasking, because I would always struggle. I would always struggle with that. And, one thing that one of my mentors told me was that, people who are good at multitasking aren't necessarily multitasking, right? They've just gotten very good at shifting priorities. And that was huge for me because that's why I stopped trying to do everything at the same time, and why I decided, I really need to be mentally present for this one task, and then I'll be taking a break, then I'll be mentally present for this next task, and so on and so forth. And I think that that's a huge piece of advice that I found very beneficial. And then another piece of advice I got was actually, back when I was an undergrad, I was at an NCAA meeting, I was at a conference, and I was talking with someone. I don't remember exactly what his role was, but I think he might have been an athletic director. I don't remember exactly. But I remember talking to him, and he was doing all these different things around the association, had all these different roles. And I was so impressed. And I just remember, I remember telling him kind of the situation I was in, where I wanted to do more with the association, but I was kind of unsure of whether that was allowed, or I was not really sure of, you know, as far as my class schedule, like just forward, whenever I felt kind of anxiety about an opportunity that was coming up, I would just say yes, and I would do it. And, you know, obviously you need to take care of your mental and your physical health, and if this is going to interfere with those things, then don't do them. But if you're ever worried about whether you can handle a task, I think you should just jump in, and you shouldn't be afraid to kind of take that step, because the odds are very, very high that, you know, you'll be successful in whatever you do, or at least you'll learn something from that experience. That was kind of a huge thing for me, you know, just saying yes to things, to more things, accepting more responsibility as they come up. I think that's huge.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, Isaiah, because this is the thing, you know, of course, like you said, you want to put caveats on this and that you make sure you manage yourself, your wellness, your mental health, mm-hmm. your academic potential and progress. You want to make sure you manage all those factors. But it's very important for you to, like, not get caught up in the paralysis of analysis, or get caught up in your fear of the what if, to the point where right. you don't act and take on responsibilities and opportunities that could really serve your benefit. So case in point, like even the podcast, like starting a podcast, there's so many questions that move in your mind. Do I want to? Do I have the time to do this? Will I be able to get guests? There are lots of doubts and questions and things that you are concerned or curious about that move in your mind. But you know, at one point, you just have to step out, do it. And it becomes an act of faith and an act of hope in that you are pursuing this so that you're able to help people. But yeah, this right. is very, very important. Very important for you to ask and not just get caught in the what if or the potential. Absolutely. Yeah, the things that could happen. So as we conclude, what advice would you give to someone who says, who looks at Isaiah and says, or they are almost lost for words? What you're doing, MUPHC plus the part of the NCAA Board of Governors and being recognized. What would you say to someone who looks at your path and trajectory so far and says,
yeah,
I want to be like you, I want to do what you're doing?
But it is very rewarding, and, you know, I definitely think it's worth it for me. You know, just the way that I look at, you know, these degrees is I see an MD as allowing me to use the current tools available, like the best possible tools available right now to treat and to heal people. And I view a PhD as, you know, being involved in the creation of knowledge and the development of tools for the future that can be used to treat disease and to help people. And I would say that anybody that is interested in both of those phases, you know, look into an MD PhD, and consider pursuing it. You know, I think it's worth it. I think, for the people who already know that they want to enter the field, I think, you know, demonstrating and this is free game for application season, but demonstrating a commitment to research is huge. Demonstrating, you know, a passion for answering questions that people might not have even thought of yet, or, you know, questions that seem super kind of far reaching. I think that that's kind of a critical thing. But, you know, I would say jump in with confidence. Like, you know, after all, like it's a path that can grind you down. If you don't, I would advise that you develop that system and feed and nurture that system. But, you know, having those support systems are really going to help you to thrive when you're dealing with the adversities of medical school and of kind of grad school. I think that's generally the advice that I would give. And I'd also just say good luck.
Okay, yeah, dude. But anyway, Isaiah, thank you so much for joining me today. It is so good, and it was so good to have you on as a guest.
Purpose of these episodes not at all for advice or medical suggestions. These are aimed to provide support to peer pharmacists in training in educational and intellectually stimulating ways. Again, these are not at all for medical advice or medical suggestions. Please see your local board and state certified health professional. The views of this podcast represent those of my guests and I.
Thanks for listening to the podcast series The New Student Pharmacist, where we discuss chemistry and pharmacy, as well as leaders in pharmacy careers, community, and chemistry and pharmacy research. We encourage you to support the work we are doing and follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts by subscribing for free. We are so glad that you were able to tune in today. Note, the views on the podcast represent those of my guest, and I take care and all the best.